health. That would be another one, right? Like, these are things, they're just conditions for that. They're not really anything more than that. But we do need to realize them, and or if we want to live good lives, right? As humans, as best as we can on the slippery earth. And by the way, it's a slippery earth, again, because these doubles don't inherently go together. It's our work as humans to try to get them to go together, to balance. But they don't. Look at nature. It's hard.
It reminds me a lot, especially of your description of the societal structure in some ways of, you know, the polises and in ancient Greece and such, and their relationship, and obviously in the most powerful city. Although it's interesting how it's broken down even to the neighborhood, or that it's such a much more local level. Do you really see the Aztecs as an empire, or is that more of a Western kind of idea of what that was?
I don't know what an empire is, right? That goes to that question. It's very clearly not the empires of the West, right? It was an extension of ordering and arranging more effectively. And they did have something like an evangelical, in the sense of like converting or going out, like a mission to go and do more of this, in the sense of like, yeah, well, if you think you're on the right path of helping organize people, wouldn't you want to help more? Right? Which is why they expand their lands and do their things. Obviously that gets co-opted into certain political missions by various figures. That's just humans, right? But an empire in that sense isn't really the case, because they saw it as, you know, more like a plant growing, right? And the point is, it's just growing out, and like, this is a branch, and this is a branch, and this is another branch. It's not, this is dominion and I control all of this stuff. And I think that's more the empire view of like, we're going to spread our reach and colonize. They didn't see it that way at all. It was more of, and now there's a new branch that grows out. We doubled again, and we have to order and arrange and take care of things and blah, 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 like that approach.
Did the Aztecs see themselves historically and through their own kind of mythological story as connected to older cultures like the Maya, or did they see a sort of separation there? Was that a different cycle, or is it just like you're saying, a continuation, a branch of that, you know, familial tree that they want to be a part of?
They were very clearly emphasized by it, and there is a common Mesoamerican culture. There is no doubt about that. I think one of the difficulties is that it kind of went both ways. So we now find that various Mayan cities would have like Nahua terms. It went both directions, because the Aztecs were dominant. The Maya were more of a federation or confederation, right? They were really a confederation. So they just kind of, they got along, but there was no central organizing feature to them. And it is different that way. It's different in how they tell their stories. They have a version of the suns also. They have a version of like the human beings under different conditions. They have four of them, not five. But the whole outlook is less centralized, right? And it does end, there is still one leader. There's still one leading person who's the speaker for the leading, you know, neighborhood of the leading city of the leading blah, blah, blah. It does kind of go that way for the Aztecs. Whereas for the Maya, nope, that isn't there. So while there's definitely some commonality, the influence by the time the Spaniards showed up was definitely from Aztec Empire into the Mayan confederated political states. So that is the direction it went. But the core commonality is, it's evidenced by contemporary sociology on the higher levels of social inflection. So I was actually on another podcast with two Mexican-American hosts, and we were talking about this because we could get what the higher level of sort of fluid synchrony is. The experimenters did this thing where they took a child and they had a researcher talking to the child, and the researcher would knock over a cup with pencils in it. And inevitably, these are young kids, there's like five at most. And the Mesoamerican kids would just start putting the pencils back into the cup without any prompting or anything else. Whereas the European heritage children wouldn't. If they were prompted, they would do it, no problem, right? But until asked, they wouldn't do it. And that's an example of the kind of fluid synchrony, like basic collaboration that happens there. And that is at the heart of the ethical outlook I was trying to articulate in The Outward Path, all right? Because I was trying to oppose the outward path to sort of Buddhist and Stoic views. Now, Buddhism is very wide-ranging, and I have a good friend of mine who is actually like Buddhist monk, and he will correct me on all the nuances here. I feel better about the Stoics. But in both cases, the view is still something like, still your mind, go out. Learn to meditate. Catch your thoughts in action. Stop them from running on. You'll be a better human being, and you can then enter the world, right? Which is why they have monasteries and things where you can retreat first, practice, then return. The Aztecs had the view that your mind is chaos. Better to lean on your friends and family. You're going to get more immediate results. And that's why the example that I give in the book at the beginning is one of when my wife and I first moved into the neighborhood that we're in. This is like a 1950s neighborhood in upstate New York, which is really weird. People sit on their porches, they walk by with their dogs, and they push their little buggies, or their children in strollers and things like that. It's strange. They say hello. So Halloween, all the children come out for Halloween. And we were told when we first moved in here to get a lot of candy. You'll get a lot of trick-or-treaters. And we bought way too much candy. We put the excess of the candy in a big platter in the center of our living room afterwards. And in order to go anywhere in my house, you pass that. And I have a sweet tooth. And so I would eat the candy, and I was breaking my diet, and I hated myself for it because I grew up Catholic. I had this whole cycle of like guilt and transgression going on here, which my wife saw. And so one day I came back home and it was an empty platter. And I was like, what happened? She's the chair of her department of philosophy over at Oneonta. And so she just told me like, yeah, I just gave it to the philosophy kiddos at my department. And she solved it for me, right? And that was a very Aztec solution, right? Fluid synchrony in a way, didn't ask her to do it, that sort of thing, right? She just came in and did it for me, right? That's the Aztec approach. Get the good people around you who will help you lead a better life. I still have no ability to resist sweets in front of me. In Aristotelian terms, I am intemperate. But in Aztec terms, it doesn't matter as much because I have people around me who enable me to effectively be more temperate. The outward path is easier to achieve, right? It doesn't take 10 years on a hill doing breathing exercises or something, or in the mountains doing breathing things. I just need a friend. Right. And that's the difference of approach, basically.
I really like the word collaboration as the way you put it. It's this emphasis on, you know, the ethics or the morals of our particular culture or society or whatever are never going to be intrinsically focused on one individual. They're always going to be focused on how we all operate together and have different aspects. And just like you explained with also the whole neighborhood idea, I thought that was a really good, almost like kind of like a reverse version of Plato's Republic, where it's like the organization of the person and the organization of the city all have these different components that all work together. But really, the organization of persons within the Mesoamerican culture is always going to be like plural. It's always going to be about you operating with your family, with your friends, with your neighborhood, all that kind of stuff, which is kind of unique and really different. And I actually like it compared to a lot of Western traditions.
And I'm trying to make the case that it's different from the West, and it's different from even like Confucius. Confucius in the virtue ethical tradition is viewed as more socially centered, and they'll have rituals. And the Aztecs had rituals, but they're used differently. So for Confucius, rituals, at least in their ethical register, are meant to develop your character. So you try a thing out so that you as an individual have better character and then hence act better. Whereas for the Aztecs, the rituals help the group coordinate. So we have an example of merchants deliberating about going to a different city or whatever else, and they have rituals there, and the rituals help the deliberation. Of course, traveling back in the day was fraught. It's worth mentioning, right? traveling to a different city over several days, you know, you get attacked by wild beasts or somebody gets sick or God knows what happens. And so it's useful to talk to other people, and you want to get the people who have the most relevant experience. So the elders, but also the people who went there most recently, you kind of put them at the center of the circle, but they even had the children come along too. And the children are in the circle and they all deliberate in their own capacity. They go with the judgment of the person who knows the best at the end of the day, but it's a deliberative process and the rituals help that happen. So the rituals facilitate shared agency in that collaboration. And so the virtue of practical wisdom, which is instantiated there, that's the ideal. It happens in a group done well. Now, if you have a bad group, obviously it goes poorly, right? But against Aristotle, who would say, like, if you only had the phronimos, like one smart guy who just knew everything, he never have to deliberate with anyone else. And the Aztecs are going to say, like, that isn't an ideal for human beings, right? So just get rid of that. The ideal for human beings is acting well in a good group. That's the ideal unit there, not a totally smart one lone dude, right? And that's how it changes the register. That's how they use like rituals differently. It does come up in their ordinary discourse. By the way, a note, they don't tend to talk about obligations. The way they talk about it socially is they'll say things like, if you don't do this, it would be dishonorable, which is the same thing as saying not realizing your obligation. It is dishonorable, right? So it often enters through this kind of like honor discourse, but they're really talking about the social role obligations that attach to your station there to act with other people. So hopefully it just adds a little bit of color to what you were mentioning.
I think the emphasis that you put, especially like setting the Confucian ritual, the Li, against the Aztec notion of rituals is actually, it's really illuminating, and it also sort of makes me look at Confucian ritual a little differently because it is individualizing, at least, right? But it's also making me realize that they are kind of taking this almost like side route to what the Aztecs just say, like, just if you, like, you want to have a socially cohesive group anyway, the Confucians are doing this by cultivating individuals who can produce good results for their communities. Well, why don't you just produce good communities by having people in groups who can collaborate well and who organize in such a way that is conducive of collective reasoning in that way, right? I mean, I think about it too, Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics kind of naturally blends into the politics, right? All of this more or less is for the sake of its politics. But it is that virtue ethics in that individualizing sense that its cash value is in its collective worth, right? Whereas the Aztecs really just cut to the chase.
Just make the ethical activities themselves collective. It's why Aristotle couldn't recognize friendship as a virtue, right? Because for him, virtue is attached to qualities of character. So friendship has to be the sum of two good characters. That's the way in. Whereas the Aztecs go like, no, look, there are virtues. Okay, in the primary instance, all virtues are virtues of shared agency, of you in relation to other people. And in deficient cases, it's just you, right? And hence, friendship is its own thing. It's a kind of shared agency with another person. There are different kinds of shared agency, right? But it's a specific kind, and it has its own virtues, you know, one of which is loyalty. You can't be a friend to someone without being loyal, right? That's just a virtue of a friendship. And so because all virtues attach to these relational activities to begin with, out of which the individual is the sort of deficient case, they can call friendship a virtue, whereas Aristotle can't, right? Like, again, this is why I find the Aztecs interesting. Like, this is my whole point. Why should we, Hale, you were asking earlier on, like, if it's like colonial era contamination, maybe, but I don't really care. From a philosophical point of view, this is super cool, right? And that's where I've got to make my case is like, look, it's different philosophically, and it is, maybe it's wrong in some ways. Like, I don't know. I'm just trying to get the word out about like, it is worth paying attention to. And I think it is, right? It's definitely a different approach to that.
I do have one kind of follow-up question, though, with this idea of, you know, collaboration and stability within society and stuff like that, which is, you also have mentioned, like, you know, this sort of, like, base level of chaos. Does this mean that, like, the Aztecs believe, though, that, like, it's all about the group and your group functioning, you know, well together and having those virtuous relationships, but eventually all groups break down? Like, that's not a stable thing. That's something that eventually turns on itself.
Yeah, it's the other side of the coin that Aristotle identified, right? So in book one of the Rimmer, caveat, I got my tenure writing on Aristotle, okay? Like, so that's why I fall back to him. But so in book one, he says, he specifies the kind of actions that he's going to consider. First of all, he's considering actions, by which he means an act plus the intention of the agent, unlike a consequentialist. Okay. But second, he says, look, these actions have to be totally under my control, because if they weren't, then basically the space for sort of moral luck enters, right? And if you're going to allow that virtues attach to things that aren't totally under your control, as the Aztecs do, because you can't control what your friend does, your friend can just fail you and blow up your relationship and it sucks, right? But the Aztecs just take the other side of that and say, like, that is the human condition. And so it exposes you more deeply to vulnerability. As a result, like, Aristotle's trying to draw a moat around the fragility of the human condition, right? And I read the Stoics as, like, purifying that move. Aristotle gets halfway there. He allows for tragedies, whereas the Stoics would say, like, no, you never have the tragedies, like, if you have the right outlook always. Whereas the Aztecs are going to say, like, no, vulnerability is just woven in, accept it. Accept that that is the case. And yeah, you're going to mess up. And you're going to mess up in part. This is partly why they're pessimists. Look, because you live well with other people, your relationships are more inherently fragile. You run greater risks. And along your life, those will break down. And you will suffer pain and loss. Not everyone goes through great tragedies, but everyone goes through lesser ones. If you live long enough, that will happen to you. There is no doubt about it. And that's why in the book I give the example of Trent Reznor as like the kind of case in point. This was in like 99 or something like that, when he was on the cover of Spin magazine as the most, I don't know, valuable artist of the year. And he was interviewed, and the interviewer asked him, well, like, about his, he would wake up every morning and basically decide whether or not to shoot himself. A Colt 38, like, by his bed, whether or not to shoot himself. And he would delay that. He was a procrastinator, right? So he'd be like, tomorrow, I'll shoot myself tomorrow, but I don't really feel like it today. And he did this for years. And so the interviewer asked him about that. And he was like, well, you know, why? You became an international star. You started your own genre of music. You're recognized for millions of dollars. Seems like that's pretty good. And he said, well, what if you got everything you ever wanted and it still sucked? That's disillusionment. And disillusionment is a really interesting way to fail. It's failure by way of success. It's when you get your goals and fail because you got your goals. And I don't think there's a more quintessential Aztec thing than that, which is to say, you will slip up. You will slip up even when you think you are succeeding. You can slip up. It is amazing how our lives work out. And yes, so our lives are inherently far more fragile. The things, the other way that I put it is, the things that make life worth living also make it fragile. They just accept the other side of the bargain that Aristotle rejected. I see it as like logical pairs, and they just went the other direction with it.
It's such an incisive sort of kind of reading against Aristotle. I mean, the fact that there is like a certain kind of fragility or vulnerability that Aristotle just a priori like writes off in trying to sort of establish this ethical project that the Aztecs really do take on. And it makes me think of just how much kind of color or maybe like flavor that is added back into the ethical life in this way, because it has that sort of like Heraclitean reflexivity to it, where you don't really have an ethical life unless you have the possibility of the failure of that life. If you just have an ethical system that writes itself off or writes itself up to. Ethics just is not being able to fail because moral action is just considered what is under your control. And the job is to just cultivate these virtues, and that'll be then you're hunky dory. You just do this and it'll all be fine. The ethics say, no, you do this. It very much well could go south, but that's just how it is. That's what a human life is. It doesn't just admit for the possibility of something like tragedy. In their pessimism, life inevitably has to be tragic in some way. I mean, I don't know, maybe that's a contingency too, right? Like, you could live a life that doesn't have anything tragic about it. But then there is almost something kind of tragic about missing out on that experience as well, don't you think?
I want to push Aristotle's, he doesn't use it consistently like this, but his use of like Makarios, the blessed life, as that sort of possibility where it somehow just escaped all of that and some people are blessed. Fine, I guess, maybe. I also wonder though, like, how deep were your relations then? if you escaped everything, like, did you do much stuff? The Aztecs would caution against maximalism in life because, you're running too much of a risk. But you can't avoid all of it. And that's why, you know, they had a different attitude towards temperance. It reflects everywhere. So, yes, they have a virtue called temperance. But that virtue requires that on certain days you become intemperate in a certain way. Like, so you get drunk at weddings. They typically had a motivation, like a prohibition on drinking, but during weddings, it's a special event. Old grandmas or whatever else people, it depended on which city, they would get drunk. And the answer is basically, life only affords you so many wonderful opportunities. Celebrate them when they come. You are a fool if you don't. I mean, is that running the risk? Sure, nobody likes being hungover, but on the other hand, that's sort of the exposure that in the small scale, that's the exposure that you need to have in order to live a fulfilling life with other people. And that's why temperance requires indulgence at certain points. It's again a balance, but that's how they balance that one in relation to other people, you know, responsibly enough, blah blah blah. You know, it's still there. That's why the goal is not really happiness. Aristotle tries to put happiness back in one sense of hedonē, elevated emotional states. He has a hard time again with that. And the Aztecs, that's the other thing. They just give up on that. They just say, like, you're not really after elevated emotional states. You're just not. You're after a rich, meaningful, fulfilling life with other people around you. Rootedness is one of the terms in the constellation of terms that could be used. So I'm a parent. First year being a parent, it's hard. Any parent who's had a one-year-old knows, like, you just sort of zombie through life. Fewer elevated emotional states. Totally worth doing, though, if you're down for it, because I find it is contributing to a rich and meaningful life, not because I smile more or because I slept in well. Having a child and taking cocaine are just not the same kind of options.
On some level, it reminds me a little bit of Montaigne, obviously the like early modern French philosopher, and his essays, in the sense of like having this kind of social and personal honesty about something like we could call it fate, or like the reality of, you know, the chaos of life, of love, of loss, of all these things, of our social relations. And obviously Montaigne in his essays is meditating on all this kind of stuff as all of these things kind of go through, and kind of recognizing that there is no like living perfection. There's just kind of like life happens, and there's all different ways of looking at it and different ways of dealing with it. You kind of do the best you can. Obviously, within the Aztec tradition, that it's really like the best that you can do is being the best person within your particular social group, community, and role, and accepting that like even that might still not be enough.
Yeah, no, actually, there's probably an unexplored connection there. I think that it's the willingness just to admit the things that you know, right? The things that we all know at a certain point. It's like, yeah, bad things do happen to good people. Apparently, we try to avoid that, but, you know, commitments in your life that make them valuable also make them fragile. There is a lot of what they would consider, by the way, this is the thing that gets the Kantians more luck. Like, it's real. Some people just end up being good because they're lucky. And I always try to get my students on this one. How many of you have ever driven while really tired? evidence shows that, you know, that's as bad as driving drunk. So the only fact that you're not a murderer is luck by manslaughter. And the Aztecs would just say, like, yes, that is a thing. Kantian gets annoyed by that a lot, right? Because then somehow extrinsic considerations somehow bear on moral values. The Aztecs were willing to just kind of accept the complexities of it. And it's like, I don't know. It just seems like, yeah, some people, like a lot of us end up being kind of lucky, good because lucky. And some people end up in bad situations and are bad because unlucky. That also happens too. Okay. That brings them close to some of the insights in Montaigne. I think some of the insights of the Greek tragedians. The appeal here, though, for the Aztecs is this comes down to us from our books, but also your common sense. And you should be able to reason about them. And does it match your common sense? And if so, that is sufficient grounds for agreeing with it, right? Ethics is, they're not going to try to like argue you through a lot of logical proofs or something like that, because most ethical topics don't need you to calculate the second derivative of anything, right? They just, that's not how it works. They have myths about the afterlife, but why those myths don't really matter. All right, because they tend to hold that like your soul kind of exists for like 4 years after a person passes. And then there are other myths that say maybe they exist for longer. But none of that really matters for the ethics, because ultimately, what is your life? Your life is a linked sequence of actions on the world stage. It's a performance. That means that you can either perform it well or poorly. Like some people can dance well or poorly. My daughter is 3 and can dance better than me. That says either a lot about her or me or maybe both. The idea is that, you know, doing it well is with virtue. There's no maximizing beyond that. Like more steps doesn't make sense. Longer life doesn't make it a better life. It's like saying a longer dance is better. Not necessarily. It's how well it's done that matters, not how long it is. The thing it doesn't need is another dance. If your life is done well here, it's done well here. You don't need an afterlife to justify this one. That would just be another dance, done well or poorly. But this one has value if it is done well. It has value, provided time doesn't go backwards, it has value immutably. It will always have been. That's enough. That's enough to give your life meaning, even without reference to a God, an afterlife, or complex theories about existentialism in some ways. Right? It's enough. Done well here has value. No afterlife. Good. That's the goal. Done with other people, but that's the goal. And that's all you're going to need, ultimately. So I think that's uplifting in a way. Doesn't mean religion doesn't have a place, but I guess it has a different place.
Thank you again, Sebastian. You've been listening to The Canadian Philosophy Show.
You can find The Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
This is Bird Note. Tree swallows glisten in the June sunlight. As they swoop and glide, their arcs interlacing in the air. Agile, elegant, masters of flight, the swallows gather near their nest boxes, clustered on posts at the edge of a marsh. A white feather flutters down among them. One swallow snatches the feather in its bill and flies upward as another swallow gives chase. After a moment, the lead bird lets loose the feather, which drifts lazily, until the second bird swoops in to catch it in midair. The aerial ballet of swallows and feather swirls on for minutes as other swallows join in the feather chase. Are the swallows just playing? Or are they competing for these feathers? Loose feathers are an important resource for tree swallows. They line their nests thickly with them, a feather bed for nestlings. Continuing research suggests that as tree swallows build their nests, it is the females who collect the feathers. Their aerial dance may well be a competition for nest lining material. And the males in the feather chase? Maybe they're just playing along. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann. BirdNote gives you the sounds of birds every day, and you get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram at BirdNote Radio.